Check, check. Hey.
Hello.
Hello.
We're live.
Hey there.
Hello. Hi, hi.
So, yeah, it's been a while since we've seen each other through screens, but it feels nice.
Yeah.
So this is one just very random Not Twiddlers hangout because, yeah, we thought it would be nice to have a little after chat after the two ADE shows with some of the people you might have seen on stage and some of the people who have been working on the show on other parts of the production. So yeah, let me just quickly introduce everybody and then we'll just start, I don't know, chatting about the shows, and then people can ask questions and join into the conversation. So yeah, good to see everybody. I see a lot of familiar names showing up in the comments. So we have Surgeon Tony.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Good to see. Yeah, good to see everyone again.
Yeah, absolutely. And Carl Klomp is sitting next to Tony, virtually.
Hello.
Okay, so yeah, shall I just say what everybody's role was, yeah, or do you want to do it yourself?
Maybe you say it.
I see it. Okay, fair enough. So Tony, of course, was on stage with the team on the Saturday night. And Carl is actually the stage designer. He came up with the building the stage in the middle of the Paradiso, and also with the monolith video screen above the stage. And he has sort of like a similar role for visuals as that I do for the music. So he basically invites several people, visual artists, to join him on his station, basically, and then he sort of directs or has an overall sort of direction of the whatever is displayed on the screen. Is that a little bit correct?
Yeah, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah,
yeah, that's true. Yeah, thanks.
Sure. Okay, so yeah, maybe we'll address it once everybody's introduced, and then people can ask questions and you can explain in more detail what you do, I guess. So next up is Tim, man down there with the beard. And Tim is the front of house engineer. Has always been the front of house engineer for all the shows so far, and is I guess the it's your continuous gig, right? You are basically the standard Paradiso front of house engineers, or at least one of them.
Yes, I'm the in-house engineer, and I'm also the team lead for the technical team there.
Okay. So yeah, Tim is the one basically making everything that we try to do on stage sound really, really good in the room. That's your job.
Definitely.
Yeah, and we'll come back to you later as well for to explain everything in detail. And last up, we have Jaco joining us from Berlin, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Great. And you were there. Nice shirt, by the way, Jaco.
Yeah, gerne.
Thanks
for the shirt. It's my new favorite one.
So Jaco was also joining the team on the stage on the Saturday. So the same,
exactly.
Same,
yep.
One as Tony was. Yeah. So I guess, I don't know, what should we talk about? I think a lot of questions come up in the comments when on the YouTube registrations, you know, where you can sort of rewatch the shows, and people make wild guesses about what's going on and how it works. And I would say there are two ways to explain what's going on. One is the technical way we do it, and the other one is the musical way that we do it. And the technical way is quite easy to explain, but you know, everything else is as much unknown to most of us at any time of the night as it is to the audience. So it's basically a wild guess what's going to happen. Yeah, anybody wants to say anything about that, or shall I just explain the technical side first, maybe?
Yeah, okay.
So simple, basically, musically, everybody, or technically, everybody has their own setup. So people bring whatever they want to bring to the table, you know, synths, drum machines, whatever, just a setup that they are familiar with. And then everybody basically makes sure there is a stereo output. So, you know, that's the signal that gets sent around. And basically of all the four guests that I invite on the stage, each of them then provides their stereo output to me. And I have a mixer that sort of sums those signals, and that mixer goes into another mixer, which has my own setup, because I have my own setup as well. I'm one of the five players, as well as the sort of collector of signals. And then basically all I do from my side, because people think that I'm sort of like the director, but that's not really true. It's basically I get all the signals in, and everybody is open all the time. So I don't cut them out. I don't sort of arrange it in terms of cutting their levels or anything. I basically balance the levels a little bit. That's sometimes necessary. But other than that, I don't do anything. And I just basically trust everybody to do the right thing at the right time. Who selects who's going at time? No, so that's what I'm just explaining. Nobody's selecting anything. We're basically all trusting each other.
I think there is somebody selecting who's going on, and it's the one who's the loudest. And then The rest has to go a little bit, like, to make space. And then at one point, like, you just go louder, and then the rest adapts.
Yeah, I guess. But so technically, that's what's going on. And then I have what I can do is, because I have all the signals coming through my setup, I can do DJ type stuff. So I can cut the bass on the whole signal, on like the sum of the signal. And I can throw on effects to make sort of buildups and rises and stuff like that. So I kind of DJ with all the signals that come into my setup, but I never cut anyone out. So it's everybody's open or has a hot signal all the time. So if something goes wrong, it's on the person who is doing the thing. I mean, you can't do anything wrong. But you can make mistakes, but we always embrace the mistakes, because that's the nature of the game, I guess. So yeah, that's basically how it works technically.
I see a lot of similar questions to, like, on the YouTube, and people are asking things like, do we rehearse before? And the answer to that is no. I'm always impressed, but there's no overlap of equipment. I assume you guys discussed this before. No, not at all. I think that I always feel like people make it way more complicated than it actually is. They're looking to make it more complicated, and the real answer is that it's really, really simple. And I think it's just our experience with performing music and listening that really plays into it the most, probably. And so on a technical side, I think it's way, way more simple than people assume it is.
Yeah, it's I guess it's true with every type of collaboration or improvisation, in that sense that the act of listening is probably way more important than the act of doing something. And the more people you add to the game, the more important the listening becomes. So basically it's just, everybody is just kind of letting things happen and sort of almost standing by for when things sort of develop. And then at some point you think, okay, well, I have something to add to this, and then you just seize your moment and go with it. And then hopefully it's the right thing at the right time. But there's no rehearsal. Nobody ever, you know, basically the timeline of the day is people arrive around two in the afternoon, one or two in the afternoon in the room. The stage is already there. So we basically start setting up the equipment, making sure everything syncs up and is connected correctly. And, you know, there's a lot of exchanging of cables and asking around, do you have an adapter cable for this or that kind of stuff. So we
screwdrivers,
you know, last minute repairs to modular cases and stuff like that. So that's what's going on then. And as soon as basically we trust everything works, you know, we do sort of like a level check, a sound check, but we never try anything musically. Like we don't try to make a plan or rehearsal. No, it's basically, okay, when it works technically, then we basically put all the equipment in some kind of self-generating patch mode. So there is some sound going on while the audience walks in. It's like walk-in music basically. And then when the room is filled up with enough people, we enter the stage and we basically take the music from that sort of self-generating patch into the jam that goes on for the rest of the night. Do you choose notes, scales, or you follow? Yeah, no. Also, that is not something we talk about. It's all intuition.
But it's not a dummy question, because in other jams I attend, there was kind of like a couple of rules, especially for those people who bring their laptops and bring prepared loops so that they can prepare their loops in scale and in certain BPMs. So I that was also my question when we had our first online meeting. I was asking like if we set BPMs or keys or something, but then you said no, and then it was even easier for me to prepare or like not prepare.
You just not do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Hey, Fritz.
I think the beginning of as a viewer from the outside, and not a musician playing with that, and maybe Tim can enhance this part. But the beginning where you just said, Jochem, where you enter the space and you start modulating your stuff, and you start. That's the most interesting point. The first half an hour, first hour, because there you see actually your chemistry, the five people who are making music, it's built there, and it's really interesting to see the what you add to the music and what you not, or what's double, or which one plays louder and which one is better or something. And so that levels a lot, and then it levels, and then there's something happening, and it's really interesting moment. And it's the first half an hour that's it's interesting.
I remember especially in the first hours, Tony was like at one point like, do you also have all the faders down? I'm like, yep.
we were just waiting.
I was preparing. I was already making patches, like prepared my modular for the next moment, prepared my drum machine for the next moment, you know, and the Iridium. So I knew like whenever there's space, I can bring any of those in.
Yeah, I think it's really freeing knowing there's so much time. There's no rush to you know, get in there. I think that really helped to know that there's just so much time to play with.
Mm-hmm.
And do you also have a preview sound of for instance, a sound loop or a synth loop where you have, do you also have a preview sound before you set it in, or are there machines that you don't have? So if you do that knob, instantly you hear it.
I don't like to use headphones. I just like to like bring the sound in and kind of work it in as it's coming in. For example, for me, if I have headphones, it puts me off, because I just want to hear the one, you know, the sound coming out of the speakers.
Yeah.
But you know, other people like to use headphones to preview stuff. That's
yeah, you have to be very focused without headphones. Like with headphones, you can just isolate quick, see what it is, and then you like blend it with the real world, and then you see if it kind of matches or not. Like I brought
headphones this time, but I didn't use them. I'm just not used to using them, so I think that's probably it as well.
Yeah, well, that's basically also up to the performer, right? Because Like you said, Tony, don't use headphones. But other people, like there is a difference between how everybody approaches it individually. You know, some people come with a sequencer which is sort of saved sequences or patterns that are saved in drum machines and stuff like that, you know, that you can just recall and add to the mix whenever it feels right. But I know, for example, like you and myself, Tony, we basically have everything running in step mode, in write mode. And there's nothing saved, nothing prepared, and everything is basically programmed on the fly, right? I don't know. Did you use any sequences, Jaco?
I didn't use prepared sequences, but I had a patch in my modular, which I thought is brilliant, which in the end I didn't really use much. So I had the Metropolis for like basic a couple of note sequences, and then I had it like somehow patched so that I can have like two shift registers making a complex melody out of it, which I can bring in, mix in a VCA, and so that I have a bit more of a complex sequence. But then I realized that this mid-range kind of guitar range was, you couldn't hear it at all in the frequency, in the whole frequency band. So I used it the least, the modular, the complex modular patch I did in the hotel room.
Right.
So yeah, in the end, that was for nothing. So this was the only thing I actually prepared. And a couple of like, I did my own presets in the Iridium. Yeah, but no like kind of patterns in my how's it called? Analog rhythm or something.
Mm.
How okay, I would do it.
Yeah, so you were running the drums also in step mode then?
Yes, yeah. I had like a backup live set of mine, but it wasn't fitting at all. It was much easier to just put like random hi-hats in addition to other hi-hats or toms or whatever. Like it was just way easier to do like one step instead of like a complex pattern rhythm. And Metropolis, somebody was asking, is like a step sequencer in the Eurorack, like a very simple sequencer, CV sequencer.
Oh, here we go. There's a clock question. That's also something that comes up now and then. I'm using something like an ERM. I'm using the SND Acme clock, Acme 4. It's basically the same thing. So it has four channels that you can stop and start individually. And you can half the tempo, double the tempo on each channel individually. And there is a fine tune. So if somebody's setup has some kind of either an old machine or a computer in the setup, sometimes you need to shift the time a little bit just to get it synced up with the rest of the setups. So yeah, a multi-clock I think is pretty essential, because if you run everything from just one clock in the system and something starts to run out, then it would require a hard reset, like a complete stop and start during the session. And that's a bit of a bummer. Sometimes things do run out. So everybody on the stage knows where the clock is. So if there's no way we can get the message across with waving or or sort of sign language, then they just come over to my spot.
Like,
and they reset their own channel. There's also actually quite a few sort of funny stories about people trying to relay messages during the set, because there is really no way to talk. Anyway.
Yeah, what was funny?
Well, there was one thing on the Sunday. You can actually see it happen in the video. I think it's around 3 hours, where there is this sort of this melody thing, a little sort of stabby sound going on for about, I don't know, I think in total it was in the mix for about 15, 20 minutes or something.
And, you know, somebody left it.
Yeah. So in the beginning, it's like, okay, well, I'm starting to notice this thing is still running. You know, that's where it starts. You think in your head, okay, well, must be.
I think I saw it. Yeah.
Must be intentional, right? And then after five more minutes, it's like, maybe this person has forgot it. And I was sort of just trying to look around on the table to see if I could sort of spot where it would come from, you know. And I didn't. I could have listened just on the preview to see where it came from, but
I thought you're always doing that. I was like, oh, he hears everything I'm bringing in.
Yeah. But I you know, the thing is, I trust everybody. So if something is in the mix, I trust that it's intentional, you know. So it's very rare that people actually throw something in and it's
forgotten
about. Yeah. So it started on the other end of the table with Uli, with Ril. And he was like waving at me, and I was like, "What's up?" You know, and I couldn't understand what he was trying to explain to me. So he walked over, like all the way around the stage, and he started to sing that sound into my ear. Do you hear that sound? That me. And I was like, "Yeah, I'm noticing it too. Is it you?" No, it's not me. So I was checking. By that time, I thought, you know, okay. It's not him. He must also have noticed it, that it's still going, you know. So I was looking, and it was Neil, and he is basically really on the other side again, you know, on the other side of the table. So I left my station and I walked around the stage to reach him, and I sang the sound into his ear, and he was like, "Oh shit, yeah, I forgot about it." And that, you know, by that time it was already there for about 20 minutes. So it took about, you know, it took two people singing the noise in each other's ear to eventually end up at the person who was still playing it.
Wow.
Anyway, but cool. it doesn't
light
happen
system
very often.
Would be good.
Yeah.
And then a tap light, so you can tap whatever is annoying, and then it appears on the other light and flashing.
We can make this happen.
So, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, let's ask Tim, by the way, what because you get fed a stereo signal. You don't need to set up monitors for us because we're playing from the middle of the room and using the room as monitoring, basically. So how do you address all the wild volume changes and things that we come up with on the stage during the session?
Well, basically I tried to set up a little mixing and mastering chain and just treat it as if I receive a two-track in a mastering type setup. A slight difference to the normal club setup that we do at Paradiso would be that we have the back speakers as well. So we run the store shows in quad. We run them quadraphonic so that sound comes at you from every corner. That helps a little bit with monitoring as well. But basically there's EQ and compression going on. I got a dynamic equalizer, a multiband one. I got some subharmonic generation. If I'm lacking something, if there is too much of something, I can take that away or add it in. And I can address all of the layers of the sound system independently. And it helps me to balance it out as the night progresses. So for instance, when the hall is empty, the speakers all the way up would be turned down. And the speakers that point towards the stage itself, when there's no people there, they will be turned down, and we address the things as they continue throughout the night. So if we reach a new particular vibe in the set, or if we start to notice sounds that are out of the ordinary, we try to address that as soon as possible. So yeah, it's mixing along with what everybody's doing on stage, really. Yeah. 8-hour mastering session.
Yeah. So do you have a good sonic picture from the place where you are set up, because you're all the way in the back of the room?
So this year, in comparison to last year's, it was a little bit more difficult because usually at least I'm in my regular place at front of house, and this year we squeezed everything back a bit so we had more room for the audience, so we could have a little more area, more room for the people, instead of just kitting it out completely and setting up the whole front of house outside of it. Which means that I was basically against the back wall, and Paradiso is this old church, which is a monument, so we're not allowed to address any acoustical issues there. So fortunately, I'm used to being in that spot because it doesn't translate very well to what you guys are hearing. But I can run an iPad from my desk, so in the first few hours, I'm always walking around and seeing how different spots in the venue sound. That helps a lot, yeah.
And it sounds like as if you have some kind of compression or glue going on. What is that?
So the desk we run in front of house is an SSL. It's the L500. So there's the SSL bus compressor,
okay,
which would be the first compressor that you guys are hitting. And then it's some dynamic EQing that's going on, especially in the higher frequencies and in the lower mids, which are really problematic frequencies in our venue because of the height of the roof. A lot of clattering going on and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, from playing from the middle of the room, from where I'm standing, at least, that's sort of on the stage side, it sounds really, really good.
Yeah, nice.
So you don't really get the, you get a bit of the acoustics, you know, like the sort of the reverberation of the high end and stuff. And there's a bit of a tail on the low end in the lower mids, but yeah, it's not an unpleasant ring, you know. It's like a, it's a very nice sort of reverb. It's
I agree with that. Yeah,
yeah. It's not a long tail, you know. It gives the sound a bit more life, but it doesn't ring forever, you know. So it's got a bit of a warehouse vibe. It doesn't sound like a church, to be honest. It sounds more like a
it does
shed.
No.
Did you all wear earplugs actually? Like,
I did.
Yeah. I didn't.
I was trying to remember. I can't.
I tried, remember. But I couldn't. Like, I should have put them in probably from.
I think I did actually.
Because sometimes I was like, "Oh, this filter, my young ears," but yeah. Then I was like, "Okay, it's my own mistake. I should have put those things in for the 8-hour jam."
Yeah, yeah, it's not really the level; it's the duration that kills you on these jams. Mm-hmm. So, but I was wearing 15 dB filters on the Saturday, and at some point I took them out because I felt a bit disconnected. Mm-hmm. And the next day I replaced them with the 9 dB filters, and I used them the whole night. So I wore them the whole night. Here we go. Do you take breaks? That's what do we say about that?
Yes.
Yes, we do.
Tony was the first one who was taking a break.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to eat something.
Yeah, that was a food break. But, you know, it's just nice. Yeah, nice to take a rest, use the toilet, get something to eat. I think I just took one break mm-hmm. During that time. But I remember the year before, I had like a stool to sit on, and I was kind of alternating with standing and sitting on the stool. And this year we all had the stools, but no one used them. So I don't know. Standing was fine this year for somehow. But
I was leaning on it in the beginning. It was actually quite nice.
Yeah, I think that for me, you know, for the length of the performance, that's the hardest thing is standing up for that long, to be honest. Not really the musical side of it or creative side of it. It's just literally standing up that long is the hardest part of it.
For me, it's focus. And I think that's why I took my first break after like 3 or 4 hours. Oh. And because I wasn't able to hear anymore. And then I was like, oh, fuck, I forgot these two faders. Like my effect sound was like this glitch effect thing. So fuck, that's me, that annoying bit. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to take a break.
Did you leave it going and then take a break? Just say, deal with that.
I thought it was Blauwand because he had a similar patch, I think, in his iPad, where he was sometimes doing a similar thing. And I thought it's him. And then I was like, oops, that was me. I'm going to have a break. And then I didn't need to go to the toilet. I wasn't hungry. Like when I'm doing this, I don't need anything. But then I just went to the toilet to just breathe for a second. I was like sitting and I was just chilling. And then Robin Kamscher came with a shot around the corner. So I had a little shot with him. And then... I went back like super energetic and my ears were fresh again. And then I had a little second break just to see the other room because I wanted to see a live performance of Robin. So I just went quick, like 5 minutes to see his setup and listen to his sound. And then I came back. Like somebody came to pick me up.
I think that for me, this is the third one of these I've done. And it really helped doing the other ones, if that makes sense. I think the first one was much more daunting, and I couldn't imagine how it would work. But having done it before, I was just much more relaxed about the duration of it and how it all unfolds, and just feeling, just basically feeling more relaxed about it.
Yeah, I think like you said earlier that the length of time is the 8 hours or 7.5 hours or whatever is really helping you to take it easy, to relax about it, you know, because you can kind of wait and depend on others for as long as you want, really, until you think, okay, now I'm going to add something or do something in the mix or whatever. So it's sometimes you can even, you know, focus on doing just percussion for an hour and or a clap or whatever. You know, it's I mean, if you think about it, you know, the type of music that we do is just there's stuff going on in the bottom end and there's some in the mid range and there's high end. You know, there's really just three elements or a handful of elements is enough to get a room going, you know, to have a full sound, full spectrum sound. So, yeah, it's before you do it, you are much more worried about, okay, how is my setup going to work and what is the range of stuff that I can do with it. But once you're there, it's all quite natural and easy going, I guess, for me at least.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I did the same as previously. I think I was like basically dubbing clave sounds for like 4 hours at least or something like that. So that was fun.
Yeah, I think I was feeling the most comfortable with my pads because I knew, yeah, like, okay, because there's space for that. Like drums was often filled with like classic drums. Kick drum sometimes was like a game, like who brings the next kick drum in.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, my melodic patch and the Eurorack, there, yeah, sometimes there was no, just you couldn't hear it, like no matter how high I put it, like it was just filled out the space. So the pads was always like laying like behind, kind of like not so front, and that was kind of like my comfort zone in the end, I figured, and then I stick to those sounds the most.
Yeah, that's very true what you say. It's even though you have this idea in advance what you can do or would like to do or you know, stuff you know your equipment can do, when you're in a jam with so many people, it takes a while before you actually find out what your role or what your range is or where your sound sit in comparison to what else is going on. So that also helps you decide on the spot, okay, I'll just follow this idea for a while because that's where my stuff fits in comparison to the rest. So it's very true what you say. Yeah,
that's also so interesting. That's what I also meant the first hour, that I don't know what you all produce, which sound exactly you produce.
Nor do we.
No, but from a viewer's point, I don't know what Jaco makes and what you, especially which sound. But I noticed that there's in the beginning, there's lots of sounds like on all frequencies, and then they starve out and then they mold more together. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the point where Jochem also talks about, that you find your spot in the magic five moment. It's what I call it. And that's it's really cool to see how you.
Well, that's another reason why anything shorter than 4 or 5 hours doesn't work.
Because
the first, you say you find it the most interesting part of the show, but I always feel that there is still some kind of I wouldn't say nervousness, but there would be. I would say it's more like a trial and error. You know, what is my role? How do I fit in? You know, it's a bit more of a battle in the beginning, you know, or not a battle, but it's like just pushing and pulling, or, you know, just trying things out, you know, sort of
how far can I go with this?
Yeah. Just sort of find out the territory, you know, it's like a station, you know what I mean? That's what it feels like. And then at some point, you know, sort of things start to click together and it all becomes one flow, and then people just, you know, let it happen. I guess that's my experience anyway.
Yeah.
I think there was a question, just a
setup question, right?
Ago about Carl's setup here. Here we go. Carl, explain.
Carl. Yes. So what you explained a bit, Jochem, it's also, we're trying to do that for visuals. It's actually so we have the middle of the stage, which is, there's a column, a monolith, three-dimensional monolith of four screens, and we can put visuals on it, and we have of course the lighting setup, And what we have, what we work with is three visual guys and one light guy. And we are standing next to each other. And we are at the front of house. Also, Tim is there. And so we have a viewpoint from a corner. And what we actually do is we have three visual guys. One is classic VJ, also doing a lot of analog video distortions and classic video clip throwing and mappings. He's doing crazy stuff. Then we have Emmanuel, that's Joost Kossier. And then we have Emmanuel Nijkerk, who's making touch design patches, which react on sound and also the camera input. And then I'm there for directing a bit and also throwing store logos and really basic line animations, which fit well under beats. So we have that three kinds of visual styles. And then I'm in between the visual guys and the lighting guys, and we all mix it together and then somewhere direct it sometimes. But that works very well. So you have also the four visual guys who are feeding stuff and just letting going in with the flow. Yeah, it's actually.
And is it true for your group or your team as well, Carl, that that there's nothing prepared, or that there's nothing synced with the music, or how would you explain that?
No, we have, of course, we have audio sync units, but that's we don't clock anything with you guys. We have beat functions where we can trigger stuff on beat, but mostly it's just we just join your flow. I forgot to tell that we have four PTZ cameras on the stage, so we can make a close up of the five performance.
And that was making me nervous when I saw it. I was like, "What the fuck?"
There are lots of cameras, also because we do the registrations. Leon is doing the registration, of course, because it's very important to us that we show this on YouTube as well, or stream it. There was a lot of cameras there, but we especially are noising it up, and distort your image, which works very well on your music. Yeah. So more like that. And then Danny, there's of course Danny of the lighting, who will has made us the setup, and he's joining the show as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. In order to set up the monolith during the whole ADE week, we didn't have any time, because on Friday evening we had a sold out rock show, and then Friday night we had a complete dance night. So we put a complete square in our roof for the monolith to be hung on Tuesday night. We put it in, and then we put our extra lighting underneath that for the different shows. We put it in, we took it out, but on Tuesday we already prepared to have the cube in for Saturday, because there was no other way to fit it into the schedule. It's really wild. Almost a week.
A week for building. Yeah, it's we noticed that playing in the middle of the stage or a venue is requesting a lot of resources to produce.
Oh no, I meant more like the trussing itself to be able to hang that from our roof. We had to put that in on Tuesday. We started building store on Saturday morning because we had no other time. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
We didn't feel. I didn't feel any of that stress. It felt no pretty need. Prepared. Everything. Everyone was friendly.
Good.
Yeah, it was finished by then. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I saw another thing about. I lost it again. Ah, here. It's a question to me. So, how do you select the collaborators for each year's session? Well, basically I you know it's in collaboration with Raaf at Paradiso, who's the booker, and we just think about a combination of people that might be interesting, and the pool of people that are available or are even willing to do this is not really really that big, you know, because it's quite a vulnerable situation you put yourself into, you know. It's like a very it's quite dangerous, to be honest.
I think you've been on it, so
you know what it is, but many people have this imagine what it is like, and
okay. They
think, oh man, 8 hours, I'm not gonna do this, this is crazy. But I think also there's so many ways of approaching a live show, you know. Some people have basically run through patterns, or you know, they have a much more sort of rigid preparation. And people who really genuinely completely improvise there's that less of them, basically. So, we just think, you know, who would be up for it, and then we just ask, and then we just slowly build up the team, you know, like we'll just, it's just a debate, a constant debate, you know, like what would be nice in this combination. I must say, I completely trust everybody that we invite, because everybody has like careers, and have been, you know, on it for years and years. So everybody's capable of doing this kind of stuff. They're all very experienced people, you know? So, it's interesting to see what happens when you put them together. That's basically the question we ask ourselves.
Do you also go for like suggestions where people comment under the YouTube, like, please next year this and that person?
You can throw in suggestions for sure, but it's a matter of availability, and you know, there's a lot of things that
and I do think it's also a bit of combination, right? I mean, you can't have you need to combine a couple of people, you know, whereas you know that best, Joachim, or you guys musicians under each
But it's other. All a gamble. It's all a gamble, because so far none of the sessions have ended in complete disaster. You know, it's there's always
no
things that go wrong.
No fights yet.
No fights.
But there's no guarantee. There's no
when
guarantee.
You invite couples, then you get the fights.
Yeah.
I meant to say that I don't know how to say it. But if you have two musicians who make more or less the same style of music, or use the same equipment, for instance, I can't imagine kitchen.
Well, but that is something
clash. A clash, yeah.
Yeah.
How do I say it? Friendly.
This is something we do discuss in advance, though. Jaco also already referred to the talk we had in advance, and this is basically it's same like this, you know. It's like we have the whole group in StreamYard, like the way we do now, and we kind of discuss what are you bringing, you know, what people make sure that not everybody brings the same drum machine, for example. How do you decide who brings the 909 or uses the Juno? Well, that's basically during a talk like this, like a week or 2 weeks in advance of the show. And then we kind of sort of tell each other what we intend to bring, and then make sure that we make small adjustments to our setups, maybe to make sure that we don't bring anything clashing or not too much of the same stuff in the same range, you know?
Yeah, like a mono bass synthesizer and a drum machine would be the easiest to think of, like, to bring. But then I think a mono bass synthesizer is not needed.
Okay. All right, well, this will keep us busy for the next 15 minutes. Art asks, question for everyone, would you please describe your setup and reasons why you chose it? Tony, you wanna have a word on this?
Yeah, I might need to look at a photograph that I took of it. I think, Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the setup I brought was basically what I was using for my kind of solo live setup at the time, and also like collaborations with Joachim. So it's based around a Pulsar 23 drum machine and the Torso T1 sequencer. And what else? I think I had the Soma, the rote, the Rumble of Ancient Times, this bleepy Soma thing.
I still didn't get. I think you explained that, but what was it again?
It's like an eight bit weird little like touch sequencer, cross modulation bleepy thing. I think I'm pretty sure that was it. But I mean, just with the Pulsar and the sequencer, I can. There's such a range of sounds I can get, like not just specific drum sounds, but everything in between, you know, like claves and hi-hats and snares and I don't know. There's a huge, for me, especially when I've got that amount of time and not this kind of immediate pressure to make techno, I can really dive into the patching of that and just make a whole range of sounds with it, weird squeaky noises and things like that. So
yeah, you always say to me, or you've said it a few times, that you, because there is so much time and you can rely on other people also, you know,
to do the heavy lifting kind of
yeah
thing.
Yeah, so you get much deeper into the sort of the vortex of the machine, really, you know.
And,
like,
and I kind of get really into this, almost like this sonic decoration, as it were, you know. There's all the heavy drums and the bass lines going on, so I mean, I'm not doing that all the time, but I can just get much deeper into that side of things. And why do I choose it? Because it's fun. I think that's the number one thing. And I'm used to using it, but even so, I get I get results sounds out of it that I've never got before. So, you know, I haven't kind of reached a wall where I'm like, okay, I've got all the sounds out of this gear. It just goes on and on and on. So that's kind of why I chose that. But I'm very comfortable with it as well.
Yeah, you were super zen. Like, always when I looked over, you were just like, but I mean, this is, I think, how you are, like, super zen. And then at one point you were like, I'm not zen, I'm just old. You'd be less hyperactive the whole time.
Yeah. Bouncing around, it's like, no, I've done that. That's okay. Yeah, so that's my answer. What about you?
Me. Okay. Well, so I have a modular case with two voices and two sequencers, and a whole lot of little bits and bobs that I use to treat drums. And I have the 909 basically taking care of my drums, and I basically run that in step mode, so it's all programmed per instrument in step. So these separate outputs are going, not of every instrument, but the most important ones, they're all split out on the multi-outs on the back into the modular, where I can use things like, you know, distortion or reverb or filters just drum treatments, you know, very simple stuff, compression, whatever. And that's basically what I do with the modular. So I have two synth voices and I have drums. That's pretty much it. And they're both monophonic synths. And I program the synths also in real time. So basically I do that on my headphones and just come up with some line or some sound that does something, and then I decide whether to use it or not when I think it's time. And sometimes I prepare a sound and that doesn't get used at all. You know, I just leave it running and it never gets its turn, basically. But yeah, things that do end up in the mix that I basically tweak them live until I think it's sort of depleted or, you know, has sort of had its time, and then I remove it again. So it's but in this setup, in with the five people jamming, it's mostly my sounds are coming from the 909 and sometimes a synth, but very rarely both synths. So it's yeah, just a few elements.
I'm not sure if you did them, but I think when you did like your the little breaks or like the DJ bits you did, the effects you put in like on certain parts were really powerful, like just enhancing, like I don't know which kind of effects you use, but it was sounding like
something. Oh, it's just a delay. It's just one delay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but it's I use the delay. It basically gets returned to a channel, which has the same, which has EQ and send on it as well. So I send it back to itself. So you get, you know, dub style. So you can make all these sort of modulating dubby effects, and also the mixer where all your or the signals of the guests are summed. It is a DB4, Allen & Heath DB4, and it has an effects unit per channel, and it kind of auto detects the tempo. And if so, what sometimes I also have some effects on individual signals from the other artists, basically. But that's just when I know exactly what's going on. If somebody has very clearly somebody is doing this sort of dub chord, or you know. I make it even more dubby by you know, just throwing delay on top of just that sound.
Yeah, but it was effectful, like make it a little break, cutting the low, and then bringing some effect up, and then just bringing it back in.
Yeah, that's
the, a bit of a structure.
Yeah, sometimes. Exactly. I mean, there's no way to do this unless one person takes that role, because. Yeah, normally if you control the dynamics of your own individual set, you know when you want to do it and how you want to do it. But if you are just jamming along with five people, it's very hard to, you know, the progression of what everybody's doing is very slow. There are usually very long arcs and things are moving sort of very carefully up and down without many things going quickly. So to have this sort of drop kind of stuff, or, you know, a nice break with to sort of build tension, it that doesn't happen automatically when all five are doing something in the mix, you know. So somebody needs to take that overall dynamics, and that's it's my role. I've thought about maybe doing a version of this where we switch places, you know.
Just rotating hour per hour.
Move around
every hour.
Yeah,
it would just spice things up.
Yeah.
I just realized I forgot. I had a tiny bit of Eurorack with me as well, just like a kick hall bass drum and a 4MS dual delay, just to add some more dubbing and yet another kick drum.
So what about you, Carl, in terms of setup?
Yeah. It's, for me, it's pretty basic. I've a lot of prepared visuals, of course, because we can't make everything there on the spot. What we do make is the live effects on the cameras, which are all their analog distortion units, homemade. I used also analog glitch devices, which I make myself way back. So we feed the camera view, and then we distort it on the music, and then feed that again into the laptop. And we have touch design patches where we mix that camera image into all sorts of generated visuals which correspond to the music, to the bass or the melody or the snares, and it's one big mix. We mostly have laptops and MIDI controllers, and then we have analog video distortion tools. Yeah, it's a lot of gear, and of course the PTZ cameras are very important to us because we can also make short shots of your fingers turning knobs, which always work very well because you see it. What you do is also what you hear, and you see that on screen works very well. So making use of that cameras on your stage is very useful. And
how do you what is your security system like? If, for instance, if one computer crashes, can the other run independently? Or
yeah, we have eventually one big video mixer which we can fully put to another source. And crashing is not so common anymore for us. It's built well nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be crashing a lot with getting glitch video into computers.
Just gonna go quick. There's like a party in my kitchen. I'm just gonna tell them to shut the door.
All right, cool. So Tim, you already said you sort of kind of explained your setup, but what is the thing you use most to control whatever you are doing?
For me, it's a dynamic equalizer. So basically a multi-band compressor that you can set up. We got a 4-band one and a 3-band one in the mixer, and I'm riding that most of the time. Yeah.
Is it a digital mixer? Is it something, is it like a plug-in thing, or what is the control? How do you control it? Is it knobs or screen? How does
it's
it work?
It's built into the mixer. So we got one big control surface on the mixer, and you got rows of faders and knobs, and you can assign those to functions of the multiband equalizer, or you can just touch it on the screen and adjust it that way. It's up to you, or do it on the tablet even. Yeah.
Okay, and that's,
my go-to tool. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's stuff that's already in the room, or did you help choosing the bits of gear that you work with there?
This is all built into the desk. It's the way it comes out of the box. It comes with like 32 different processors that you can mix and match, and you can make separate chains out of for different outputs that you have, and it's quite cool. Yeah.
Are you talking about the SSL desk? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you actually have like parametric EQs in case something is standing in the room?
Yeah, we do, but we also use a lake system, which is our speaker management system. And in there, you can use the system EQs. You can address specific issues with specific drivers or with parts of the sound system. So what I do on the desk is more of a global type thing. And if you really want to dive into a specific speaker or an area of the room, you can do that in a separate tablet that's running a lake software. Yeah, that's what most people use for that. So two different places to adjust. Yeah.
Cool.
Nice. And you do mastering for records in the studio where you are now, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Because it's a sort of a similar job, but in a way also completely different, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels the same sometimes, to be honest. Yeah, live, of course, you only have one go. And the nice thing with mastering is that you can always go back the next day to make a tiny little adjustment. But yeah, here I work with an hybrid type setup as well, and I think that's the same as I would like to do in my live shows as well. Maybe one or two pieces of outboard or completely digital, and take it from there. I fully embrace the digital nowadays.
And do you feel you can keep your hearing healthy if you do mastering in the studio and doing weekend gigs as a front of house mixer?
Yeah, I think you have to be religious about wearing your earplugs and taking regular breaks. I think especially the, like you said as well, the length of the exposure to the noise, including sound check. I mean, noise at least 7 hours a night, 2-3 nights a week. That's a lot. So you need to take regular breaks of like 15 minutes. You need to be out of the noise, out of the people, and wear your damn earplugs. I don't have anything in this. I've been doing this for a long time, and it does help a lot, I think. Yeah.
Does Good. Anyone don't of you ever had tinnitus? Did you ever have tinnitus or something in your life?
No, but most of my colleagues do. In this mm-hmm. field of work, most people end up with tinnitus. Yeah.
What is that? Sorry.
Sorry, tinnitus.
It's the constant ringing in your ear.
I sometimes have the opposite, but I'm not sure if it has to do with the weekend gigs or if it has to do with stress. But sometimes I have like this, I don't hear on one ear anymore, like for a couple of seconds. It's just like, ooh.
Yeah, I get that. I don't have tinnitus, but I have that type of effect. It's like a sudden weird
shift of
misbalance in the hearing. And it's like, ooh. And then it's gone.
It's so weird. Yeah,
it's very strange.
I think it's a pressure difference in between the inside and the outside of your ear that's rebalancing.
That feels correct. Yeah, you recognize that.
But fortunately, no tinnitus, and I've worn earplugs for a really really long time.
So yeah, I do have tinnitus since the mid 90s. I already have it, but it's something that is. It's there when I talk about it and when I consciously think about it, but other than that, I never hear it or never it never bothers me. It's there, but it's not there, if you know what I mean.
Okay, let's shift. So now,
if I can focus on it and then I hear it, but if I don't mm-hmm. focus on it, it's never bothering me. But do take care of your hearing for sure. Okay, so we still have this question. I had the feeling that this was going to be a long one. So, Jaco, what was your setup?
I brought the Analog Rhythm just for like comfort drums and bringing like in some rhythm element. And then I had my Eurorack, which I described before, with like the patch and two oscillators to make like melodies, mono, mid melodies. And I brought the Iridium core, like a polysynth, a small one. And I had a little rack with some Eurorack inside with a chain of effects, which I had on the send return, which I could like route any of the instruments I brought through. I just brought it as my security system in case I don't come up with an idea. I can just make like any random sound and just run it through effects. So I do something. So I had it like sometimes on hi-hats, which were then glitched and did like another rhythm and more like an off kind of whatever the rest were doing. Sometimes I just did like a single note on the Eurorack, which was then going through like phases, delay and some buffer of a delay module. In the end, I mainly use, I think the last couple of hours, I mainly used the Iridium core with the reverb because this was then I figured, okay, that's comfort. That works. I can just press some of the notes or put a chord in with a chord function in it. And it sounds like kind of a big change of emotions with the chord progression stuff. That's it actually. And I think it was smart to bring something, if I can say that. It was smart of me bringing this effect unit because it was always backing me up when I was feeling insecure. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to do like a single tone and it sounds a bit complex and adds something odd to the static pattern I have in mind. If that was clear.
yeah, for sure.
And then the rhythm, yeah.
Oh, hey, Megan. Hello, Megan.
Hello.
No, I was wondering because it was your first time. Tony's already done a few of those before we did this one. But was it for you, did you have any expectation in advance? And did it turn out the way you thought it would? What is your feeling about that?
Expectations, I don't think I had much. I was hoping for these magical moments where everything clicks and you're like, oh, that's cool. And you look at like into the round and it's like, yeah, we're going to do this. and the biggest fear was that everyone is searching for sounds and you need to be quicker.
Yeah.
And the other worst case scenario is when everyone is trying to be louder, which I think it calmed me down that I knew there's a front of house person and you, Jochem, doing a little bit of balancing all the incoming signals. So these were like the worst case and the best case. But apart from that, I wasn't imagining so much because I thought the thrill has to be in the moment. And I was keeping just my energy for that, for the time we're performing, and not like spending too much in advance. I was just thinking of like cases of what happens if something is freezing, like any machine, or if my clock runs out. These were just the thoughts I had in advance. And then this was all clarified with our first online meeting, like with the ACME clock and Tony saying that there's enough time. And yeah, like, I just, these were just like my fear fantasies and they didn't happen. So yeah, there was, as I just said, there was just this one moment where I thought like, oh, I'm not able to focus anymore for that moment. I'm not able to hear anymore. What am I doing? What is it I want to do? What is it the other ones are doing? And then I somehow started to realize the first time the delay of the room. And then I wasn't sure if it's my machines lacking. So I went like three times to the ACME and pressed, and I was like still there. So I thought, oh, it must be me. So I'm gonna go and do a little break. And then when I came back, I was able to hear clearly, and everything was making sense again.
Yeah. The thing about the playing like this is that you are as much a spectator to the whole thing as the maker or the artist, you know. Because you just use the word being in the now, you know, and I think that's really what describes the experience the best, you know, because nobody know in the whole room, the audience doesn't know, and the people at the station in the middle who are playing are equally unaware of what's coming next, you know. So you can kind of predict it in terms of energy, you know, where it's going. You can feel sort of a slight direction, but you really never actually know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very different than, for example, playing a DJ set or whatever, because you have this kind of fixed structure of records that you are playing. But with five people being in control of the sound that is currently playing, things can take a turn at any minute, you know, or any
especially
second.
Five people you never made music with and person. You just, you know, your own skill, but you don't know the other people and how they behave. Maybe they're machos, you know. I was like, maybe they're machos.
You really do need to trust each other on that, you know, that everybody is behaving and not sort of becoming a big ego in the group or whatever. And then just give everybody enough space to do their thing as well. You know, it's pushing and pulling a little bit, but yeah, it's very much in the here and now because nobody knows what's going to happen.
I wanted to say, I realized that the crowd was such a different crowd than from a regular techno party where you go, where it's like, like on a weekend, a techno club where there's no live sets. It was usually when you play a live set, you have like a couple of gear spotters and the whole room was a gear spotter. And it was like way more like older people, I would say. Maybe we are not going
hey, watch it.
Not like the young TikTok ravers. And everyone was like so patient and so interested and gave like so much energy that I think made it also like a really nice experience and special.
Yeah,
I think by now people have seen or have had the chance to see the registrations of the previous events on YouTube. So then they kind of know what to expect in terms of what kind of type of music or type of experience with the visuals and everything they can expect. But I feel there's a, because of the stage, the way Carl designed it, that you are very, very close to the people who are playing and that you can see through, as an audience, you can see through the stage situation. So you see performers from very, very close up, and you see faces, people's faces on the other end of the stage. Normally when you're in a room, you know, going to like a DJ playing or whatever, Everybody's facing the same way, and only the first row of people have unobstructed view of whatever is going on the stage, and everybody else in the room is watching somebody's back, you know, or the back of their heads. And with this setup, the way Carl put it together, it makes it very theatrical, because you have people standing around and you see faces. You only see faces. That's a whole different experience. And so there is a willingness of people to kind of wait it out, you know. They're not impatient, and they have less of an expectation where things are going, and they are more prepared to just let it happen and to just see where it goes. I think that's a big difference I feel in the way people behave, or the attitude of the audience. I think that's something you clearly notice with these sessions.
I think it's also the nature of it, the way that it's this constantly mutating and evolving stream. It's like very quickly everyone gets, you know, the performers and the audience all get kind of drawn along on this weird journey, and it has this kind of cumulative effect. That's really powerful, and I think as a result of that, you have with the open-minded audience, but just the way the stream of music works, it draws people along into probably much weirder places than you would get from like a DJ set. But that's what I really like about, you know, live sets, and particularly, you know, several people all collaborating together. I think I think you can go places that are very different from DJ sets.
Mm-hmm. It's dedicated people going for, like, I remember going just for live acts to the club, like just going for this 1 hour, and this is like a whole room of those kind of people. And I sometimes realized, like, whenever I looked quick, like, into the crowd, people were like doing this, or like they were doing that. And then sometimes you look to the right, where there was, like, because I was at the corner, I always saw like different people standing there and explaining each other like the setup of all of us. So it's kind of educational as well, I think.
Yeah, there's a bit of a nerd factor in like you said, gear spotting people. No, but at the same time, I think there is a bit of that, but at the same time, there's also less of a distinction between the performers who play and the people around it. You know, there's a more of a unity going on between the two. I think putting people in a circle like that makes them more aware that they're a participant in the whole thing. Normally on a classic stage situation where when you are watching people's backs, you know, it's a more sort of individual experience, if you know what I mean. You can be with others, you know, but you don't get the same eye contact or human expression, visible all the time. And I think it's a more a participating role of the audience.
I think also the height of the stage makes the audience believe they can overview the gear, so they have an understanding, more or less. You have the idea that you could understand how it works, you know, if you see the gear, and there's nothing. There's not a black box or something. You don't understand. I don't understand it, but I could maybe understand if I all see it.
It's definitely, I see that happening in the comments, exactly the thing you described now. And it's pretty much a compliment to you, Carl, because people sometimes say, I have no idea what's going on, but it looks amazing. You know what I mean? So it's like they see a lot of technical stuff going on, but they also realize at the same time that there's interaction between the performers. And although they don't have a clue what is actually happening, there is this notion that there is musicianship and improvisation going on, because that's the way it looks, you know.
That's work being done.
Yeah, yeah.
How was it actually on Sunday? Because there were like a couple of laptops. Like, how was the setup there?
Yeah, there was the Mike and Uli have this project together called Out of Place Artifacts, and they do live shows together. And so they decided to bring the gear that they use for their joint live show, which has two laptops in there. I have the feeling they depended less on the laptop material than they thought they would be using. Because they also had like polysynths and everything, and I think, yeah, most of what I could see was going on was that they were just using the hardware more than the laptop stuff. But there were some like audio files, effects that I could hear were coming definitely from Ableton, and I think they used them mostly as a sampler, you know, so just one shot samples or maybe loops or whatever. But there was nothing like whole arrangements coming from the laptops. And I think, yeah, the only technical difference is that they both needed a bit of time compensation because the laptops were a little bit early. So I had to delay the MIDI clock a little bit on their stream. But other than that, it felt like they were just participating with live input, you know, as much as the people who are using exclusively hardware. Why laptops were allowed? There are no rules, you know. This is just five people coming together, bring a bunch of gear and hit start and hope for the best. That's basically the whole format. So if they want to bring a laptop and it's the instrument of choice, it's fine. It's just maybe there is a perception thing going on, because as soon as there is something with a screen on stage, people tend to think, it must be coming from the computer, you know. That's the only thing, but I don't care, you know. I know what's going on, and I know everybody is doing things on the spot and putting themselves in a very, I wouldn't say dangerous, but it's putting your, it is a very uncertain situation. You make yourself quite vulnerable, and whatever instrument you choose, there's always a risk of you fucking up. So,
and sometimes a computer is just the center of a setup for, in case like you want to sync up a USB syncable devices, or you have an effect chain you always like to use, and it's and maybe the rest of the setup is already so much to carry that you just bring a computer to bring everything together and use your send returns.
Yeah, true. It's a tool in the range of tools that are available, and I know for a fact that trying to do something that you prepared in the studio earlier, or that you are used to doing in your own live shows, would make it very hard to blend. You know, it's better just to listen to what's going on and try to you know react to that, than to try to force something that you have come up with earlier. You know, so that just doesn't work.
Yeah, very much agree with that. I don't know, just seeing people assuming, just asking what, you know, if we prepare stuff, and like Joachim said, you know, that actually makes it a lot harder. And just that act of just listening and being in the moment, that's the easiest way to approach it. Everything else just makes it more difficult, really.
Yeah.
I find it a quite good exercise for creativity. Like, I think you could sell this as a creativity workshop, making a jam with professionals, just to like come up with ideas with the ingredients you bring with your favorite synthesizers, and then, but not coming prepared is, I think, the best to train being creative.
Well, the preparation is in all the years that you have worked on this, on these instruments, and all the years that you have practiced making music in all kinds of other situations. And you don't only bring your technical setup to the table, but you bring all your experience, knowledge, and wisdom, in a sense, you know, to the table. That's what you bring. And I think that is the thing that
choosing the right instruments, I think, is like finding the best tools for your
well yeah exactly
needs.
well you You bring the tools for the night. You know, you bring your setup for this particular occasion, but you bring your experience to be able to deal with it.
Yeah, that's that was the point. I think we were talking about earlier about people always ask about the gear that we're using, but I think really the important thing is like all the time we've put into, you know, creating music, performing music. I think that's probably a more important factor in it than actually what machines we're using.
The skill set.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the time.
the sheer time.
The many hours you spend on that little knob.
Yeah.
Together with the other knob.
I'm scanning the comments for interesting questions. See if there's anything.
That's cool, Tony. That you had. Then do you have one synth that you can bring and you can like a really small device which you can bring always and you can more or less work an hour on it or make music an hour on it. Like you have one device where you spend that many time that you're sure you can put out an hour of music?
Yeah, I... how many synths? Is it like a year or 2 years? I don't know. The Pulsar 23 machine is kind of the center of my setup, I guess. It's just fun and I can get a variety of sounds out of it.
Nice.
Yeah, well, you know, I think choosing a setup is very personal, but there is something that is a good sort of rule of thumb to choose your setup, and that's it should have a good balance between the range of sounds and range of stuff you can get out of it. That shouldn't be too small, but it certainly shouldn't be too large, and the controllability. So, you know, having too much to keep your head around at the same time makes things very difficult. So it should be simple enough to be able to react very quickly. So in that sense, it should be something very easy to control with just a few parameters, and then the range should be big enough so you can basically find a solution for every situation, but small enough so you don't get lost.
Not overcomplicated, because yeah, it's always that thing where being on stage is so different to being in your studio. You can deal with a really complex situation in your studio, but when you're on the stage, you lose half your mind, I think. So
everything you prepare for, pretty much 90% of what you prepare for is out, completely out of the window as soon as you enter the stage.
it was something that me and Colleen, Lady Starlight, came up with about how you're 50% stupider when you're performing, and it really is true. No. Oh, okay.
No kidding.
Well, I am.
I think everyone is. Yeah.
I'm 50% stupider when I perform. So yeah, it's just like don't make something that's overcomplicated, because you get there on the stage and you go, what did I do? Why do I torture myself like this?
Yeah, I learned that with my modular patch. Like, I was giving a lot of thought to it and it was making sense, but when I switched it on, I was like, where is that sound even? Like, I couldn't like locate where to find it. So I figured I just turn all the shift registers and quantizers off and just go with this like one melody with like three notes or one note even, just it was much easier. Yeah. And there are so many distractions. Like, there are like people around you which are constantly moving. There's like flashing light. There's like sounds you have to like put in your brain somewhere and find like the gaps. Like, there's like so much happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you're listening what's going on, and you think, okay, let's see what my next move can be. And then by the time you've programmed something, it's already the moment has moved on to something completely different. So it's like, okay, well, never mind. okay. So let me see if any other interesting questions that we haven't covered.
I see something about ego issues.
Ego.
Well, I don't notice there anything.
To be honest, I haven't yet had any of that kind of stuff going on during these sessions. Everybody's just really enthusiastic and up for it, you know. It's like you put your stuff on the table in the beginning of the afternoon, and it's just really nice to see so much gear and everybody's really sort of hyped up about for the gig. So I think it is a completely different game than playing in sequence of people. If you're all playing together, you all feel equally responsible for what's going to happen. So yeah, people would kind of they kind of keep the total picture in mind rather than their individual needs or plans. Everybody realizes it's a common effort.
Yeah, I think you need a little bit of ego, though. Like, if you take yourself too low in the volume, like, which I think I did in some parts, I was like, okay, I have to go a little bit louder in order to recognize and to find a place in there. So a little bit of ego is, I think, healthy. And then after the shot, thanks to Robin, I was like, okay, now it's mine. I'm going to put all my levels up. Here I am. So I think it's there's a healthy ego thing. There was a healthy ego thing going on.
Yeah, here this is a question that I wondered this myself before we invited Karen, and it's the same is true for Voices from the Lake and Out of Place Artifacts, because if people have this sort of common sound or shared sound, is that going to affect or in any way the total sound? But I think in this case, they did have, technically, they did have a very similar setup as they used for their current shows. But I felt they were playing more like individuals rather than as Karen. So there were some Karen moments clearly when there was interaction going on between them, but I also think they had there were many moments when Jamie was not doing anything and Arthur was in the mix and vice versa, you know. So it was also them as individual musicians, so I didn't think I don't think it made that much of a difference. I mean, yeah, there was the Karen sound sometimes, but
I think that's why you invited them as well, to get a little bit of a Karen sound here and there. No.
Well, it's I don't know. Well, I thought it was nice to have people who played together who have some experience together before. In the team, because that kind of builds this this trust in advance, you know. Like Tony and I have a project called Multiples, and we do a show together, which is also completely improvised, and it just feels good to have this this trust that there is always going to be something a dynamic going on in the group that kind of can carry the show if everything else fails, you know. So it's more that.
On the other hand, I think conversely, it could make it more difficult rather than more easy if you have a pair who are used to performing together and they're expecting to perform in the way that they normally do and interact in the way they normally do, and I think to an extent you kind of have to let that go and just join in with what's happening and not expect to bring your usual kind of duo thing. So I think it can work both ways. It's good to have that performance trust, but you don't want to attempt to perform the in exactly the same way that you normally do, because there's there are three other people as well.
Yeah, I also want to address this one. This is actually quite funny. The Borg in Volcanic says the intro of the first day was super Karen-y. Well, this always happens that people seem to recognize ingredients of certain participants of the jam. Ah, this must be Yako Yako. This must be Surgeon, or something like that. But more often it's not, and it's the wrong guess. What happens is you also tend to kind of play towards each other. You know, like you do stuff that that you think could fit with the sound of the person you're jamming with. So you kind of play in that direction, or make the sonics kind of fit in that direction, and then it gets mistaken as being coming from that person, but it's actually the other person trying to sound like them. That sometimes happens, and you know, to be honest, 80% of the time people who are playing don't have a clue where everything is coming from, so nobody knows from each other most of the time what sounds they are actually contributing at the moment, or and what they are doing. You know, it's just the total picture you keep an eye on, but what's coming from where, nobody knows. Even I don't know. Even I can preview the sounds from each individual artist, but I usually don't, because I'd rather keep my mind on the total sound and try to make that work. It's not that important to know what's coming from where.
Yeah, I have no idea. Sometimes you're like, oh, that's me. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's me. Yeah.
I've also had it where I'm like, yeah, I'm this bass line I'm doing is so cool. It's so cool. And then you're like, oh, it's not me.
It wasn't me.
Well, you know, it's cool anyway, but that wasn't me.
But it isn't as there was a question about did each artist's input get recorded separately? If so, it would be awesome to be able to play back and set the toggle them individually to see who does what. So and afterwards you can, oh, that was you playing. Oh, now I can remember. It could be cool.
And you failed. No.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, good luck to the person. Well, it doesn't get recorded like that. It's just a stereo recording of everything. But would you go through 8 hours of fucking four tracks try to figure out who's doing
no
what?
Chance. I mean,
that doesn't sound like fun to me, to be honest. Anyway, but we don't. That's not the way it's set up, so it doesn't even make sense to think about it like that. But it's just everybody is listening to the sum of the sounds, basically, and that's what they're responding to. I don't know. Is this does this cover everything? Are there any more questions or any more things that you there in the comments want to ask about this? Okay, well, let's ask Jaco this. How do you handle nerves before and during the show?
I think I try to do as normal things as possible, like the most regular things you can do to not think of like what all can go wrong. So I try to go to the toilet like 5 times and then I'm going to eat like before, because usually on days of performance, I generally forget to eat. So I try to focus on food and water. And I probably vape a lot, which is not the best thing to do. But generally, I'm not the best person to ask how to handle nerves, because I'm usually generally a nervous type of human. So you better ask the Zen master or the older ones.
Oh, Tony's.
Yeah.
The experienced ones.
Yoga. No, I don't know. What was the question?
How do you handle your nerves before a show or before that kind of show?
Well, I think, like I said before, because I'd taken part before, I felt much more at ease about it, really. So I didn't have so much. I have so many nerves about it. It's just, it's more like excitement and anticipation because you never know how the combination's going to work out. You know, I was just really excited to hear what would happen.
Exactly. That's well said. Because I think this is also what I'm doing in my brain. I'm just like keeping the energy instead of wasting it in advance and worrying or like being nervous. I try to keep it for the moment, like, and use it as adrenaline for the thrill, which is fun in the end.
Yeah, it's anticipation rather than nerves, I guess. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. I don't get nervous at all. I feel, no, seriously, I feel, you know, these events they require quite a lot of preparation in terms of organization and, you know, talking and blah blah blah, emails, and there's a lot of stuff going on that I like to do, but I'm not really that good at, you know. And then when I'm on stage, I'm like, finally I can have, this is the fun part, you know, this is the moment that I spent all this time preparing for, and then it's basically everything is out of the window and it's just music, and I love it. So I'm really looking forward to when I can finally go to the stage and, you know, make some music. So it's anticipation. I would say the same as Tony. It's but there's no nerves or anything. What about you, Carl?
Well, I do have a lot of equipment that's could fail, and and we also have the. It's like, I mean, the visual part, and it has a how do you call it, to not degrade it, but it surfs on music, you know. So it's the second artistic performance. We need the visual and the light needs music to stand apart. I mean, both cannot live together, cannot live separately. But so that does pull the pressure down. If there's no music, then it doesn't have any sense to... but we do have to perform with you guys without knowing where it goes also. So there's a bit of nerve in how it's going, and if it crashes completely. Yeah, I mean, that's always a nerve, but... going with the flow, that's in the moment, that's the best thing. Yeah, staying in the moment and show the flow. Yeah.
Do you have an aesthetic that you that you are hunting for?
Minimalistic. I mean, that's always the aesthetic, as little as possible, with one line, one lamp, showing the emotion of the music. I prefer to have one lamp and one straight line in the LED screen that is the same frequency as what we hear. That's what we aim to. Yeah.
What about you, Tim? Is there any thing that can go wrong when in your setup? Anything you're nervous? Nervous about?
Nothing I get nervous about, but there's a lot of things that can go wrong. There's a lot of points of failure in between you and the sound coming out of the speakers.
Oh, yeah.
Most of the stuff has backups. If one of the amps fail, I don't think the audience will notice. There would have to be something going ridiculously wrong, like a desk crashing, something like this. But on average, it wouldn't take me more than 5 to 10 minutes to get the sound back on. And it never happened, knock on wood.
Knock on doors.
At least not in parody, so knock on doors.
One of the three doors.
Your pick.
They're doors to different dimensions.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
But no, there's quite a bit that can go wrong, actually. Fortunately, it never does, because the stuff that we use is very stable and reliable. actually, the first time I worked store, my main concern was the stuff on the table. I was worried about the setups, something starting to drift, some power issues. MIDI can be a bit finicky here and there sometimes, but fortunately nothing on that end either.
Yeah, we haven't had any disasters, but yeah, it can. No. That's definitely something that can easily go wrong, because everybody who uses electronic gear knows that even smaller setups can have, you know, unexplainable stuff going on, you know, and things that exactly. that give problems and need troubleshooting. And so far, all the setups have ran without any issues. Main thing is, of course, sync, but that has never been an issue because of the clock. But I mean, you can get failing cables or whatever, you know. I don't know. But at the same time, it's also not really that much of a problem, because there's always four other people that produce sound, you know. You do have space to fail, basically, technically.
Never going to run out of kick drums.
Yeah.
And I think back to the question of how to not be nervous is like having a proper sound check, coming early enough for sound check, getting everything set up so you feel safe and there's nothing to worry anymore.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, and know your tools, right? I mean, that's... Know your tools. If you have one tool but you know it very well, then you can work hours on it.
Yeah,
my experience
for sure.
All right, so I think we've pretty much covered everything, right?
I smell food for my kitchen.
Oh.
they cooked.
Okay,
I hope we do this again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Always lots of fun.
Yeah, for sure. It's been nice to be able to explain some things, because every video there are so much questions in the comments about how this works. So that now you know, we don't know how it works. We just get the stuff, put the stuff together, press start, hope for the best, and enjoy ourselves. That's basically all there's to it, I guess.
Jamming.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, guys. Thanks, everyone. I think
we should
call in the night. Thanks for joining. And everybody, thanks for joining who was in the comments. And thanks for your great questions. And I hope to all see you at one of the next editions somewhere.
When is the next edition somewhere?
You will know very soon. But there will be next ones for sure. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. And
all right. Thanks a lot.
See you later.
Bye-bye.
Ciao. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Nice to see you. Bye-bye.